Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 388. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Go on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can, of course, go over to Twitter, type in This Show Is So Gay, that's our handle, and follow us there. And if you have a spare second, go to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have another jam-packed show for you. We must get started with our first guest. Let me introduce him. Ian Harvey is an award-winning comedian, actor, change agent, and so much more. You've seen him as Margaret Cho's opening act for years and years. You've seen him as a cross-country headliner and a groundbreaking comedian, unafraid to joke about subjects that no other comedian has ever touched. He has performed in some of the world's most prestigious comedy festivals, including Just for Laughs in Australia and Canada, and the Melbourne International Comedy Festival in Australia. Ian made his acting debut as Dale in the critically acclaimed Golden Globe Emmy Award-winning TV series Transparent on Amazon. He also guest starred on Mistresses, on Young and Hungry, and has made appearances on such late-night fare as The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore. Most recently, Ian filmed his one-hour stand-up comedy special, May the Best Cock Win, for CISO, and we will tell you how to watch that. But first, Ian, welcome back to This Show Is So Gay.
That is the most amazing introduction ever.
Well, one of the reasons that I love that intro, because as I just told you off the air, it was 3 years ago today, which is always a little weird, but 3 years ago today that you were on the show, you do have a sense, Ian, that your bio was completely different 3 years ago today.
It was really different, yeah. It totally was, yeah.
How do you wrap your mind around everything that's happened for you in your career?
I take it a day at a time, honestly.
Yeah.
Like, things are really going well, and I'm having a ball, but really, you have to, like, just, like, take it a day at a time and take it for what it is on that day. And some days, it's, you know, it's a rainy day in L.A., and sometimes it's cleaning up dog poop in your house because your dog refuses to go out.
There you go. There you go.
And some days, it's, like, hustling to auditions and or going to set or... hustling to get comedy gigs. So it's different every day. So you just keep your feet on the ground and keep looking forward, you know? And it's really exciting. It's been really fun, and I've learned a lot. If you had told me 3 years ago that I would get to do the things that I've done since our conversation, you know, to be acting, and for someone to say, hey, you know what, come with me. I want you to try this acting thing. And I'd be like, well, you know, I haven't done that since eighth grade. And they're
right.
Like, trust me, we think you can do it. And we'll make it safe for you. So just come on, try.
Wow.
If you had said that and it would have led to all these things, I wouldn't have believed you. And let me just tell you that every time that something great has happened career-wise, it has often been because some really great woman has wanted to elevate my voice.
Look at that.
Or elevate... You know, that to me is like, that's incredible to me. I'm so grateful for Margaret. I'm so grateful to Jill Soloway. It's just incredible. So it's a day at a time.
Well, Margaret was on our show a few weeks ago, and I have to tell you, one of my favorite stories involving your career was the way the lore goes, what I've learned online, is that there was some reluctance on your part to be fully out in front of LGBT audiences, and after talking to Margaret and her giving you some advice, that you said something along the lines of, I can actually be of service here, I can tell my story. Is that lore close to being true?
Yeah. You know, I was out on stage as queer, but I wasn't out on stage as trans.
Yeah.
And when I met her and started touring with her, I was afraid of saying that in front of audiences. And I know it sounds ridiculous because her audiences are so smart and liberal and queer adjacent. So I just thought, you know, what? I know it sounds ridiculous, but I'm most afraid in front of LGBT audiences. And she's like, why? And I said, because they're the people who I want to love me the most.
Yeah.
And she said, you know what? You coming out as trans, people need to hear your story. You need representation. And you could be that person. You could be of service to others in sharing your story and allow people to feel like, you know, that they are not alone. And
right.
And that's what I realized. I realized, you know, when you tell your story, whether it be in TV, film, whether you are a writer or whether you're a songwriter or whether you are a comic, no matter what the art form, when you tell your story, you and someone else relates to it, you help them feel like they exist.
Right.
And let me tell you, growing up in Maine, I didn't have anybody that looked like me, that talked like me, that said the things that I felt. And so that really struck me when she said that. I'm like, oh, yeah, like people do need representation, even in this art form. And what I learned was, you know, it wasn't just trans people who were coming up to me and saying, my God, I can really relate to your story. It was a lot of other people, too. It was a lot of other people who are not trans-identified, but could identify with the discomfort in their body in relationship to their gender. So she was right, not just about LGBTQ audiences, but about everybody in the room was looking for something to relate to. And so that, to me, was life-changing, that moment, that permission of why I was doing what I was doing. You know what? You're going to help people feel like they exist. That, to me, was one of the, a real, like, I want to say game changer, but it was a real shift in my art form at that time. It just released me in a way that I was like, oh, right. There are no other trans comics out there. This was 15 years ago. I started doing stand-up, and I moved out here 4 years into my career. 6 months after moving here, I met Margaret, and this is what she's saying to me. And there weren't any trans comics at the time, you know? I mean, not that I knew of the trans guy comics. Maybe there, I actually had met a couple of trans lady comics, but there weren't anybody that, you know, was, someone was sort of pushing along and mentoring and elevating their voice. And so I'm so grateful for that experience because it really was a pivot for me in what I wanted to achieve doing stand-up.
Empowering stuff. I have to ask you the question that I asked Margaret. You know, there's some stuff going on in the country, I don't know if you've heard, that perhaps is not so entertaining. And if someone were to follow you on Facebook, as I do, you know, you don't shy away from political posts. How do you navigate that tricky balance between, all right, I'm here to entertain, but I also definitely have stuff to say about what's going on in this country?
Well, part of my resistance is to... Like, listen, it definitely crossed my mind that someone might yank me out of my bed in my sleep for something that I would say about the current administration. It has crossed my mind. And I'm like, and then I thought, well, you know what? If that fucking happens, I will gladly be yanked out of my bed. You know what I mean? Like, I will not be silent. This is not a time to be silent. This is a time to speak out about every single thing that you hear. And sometimes it's so ridiculous.
Right.
Absolutely ridiculous. Like, I was thinking about, like, right before the inauguration, like, he went on a thank you tour.
Right.
So ridiculous. Like, it's kind of like, that was like the embodiment of getting likes on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Getting likes on Facebook. You know, for him, it's not enough to have people, like, tweet at him, and he needs to actually go out and have people stroke him in person. The place that he missed, though, on his thank you tour was Russia. That's what should have been his first stop on the thank you tour. But I think that, you know, I just think this is a time, Margaret and I talked about this right after the election. I was super freaked out and, you know, talking to her Thanksgiving and, you know, sitting around a table, you know, really flipping out and, you know, thinking, going, okay, so do we stay? Do we leave? What do we do? You know, what do we do to fight? What do we do to it? And, you know, she said to me at that time, in that moment, I'm the most eternally optimistic person on the planet. I am annoying to people because I'm like, I can kind of twist anything into something good, and I just could not twist this into something good. And she said, you know what, if anything that comes out of this that's good, it's that really great art is made.
Yeah.
And after she said that, one of my most favorite jokes about Trump came up. Like, it's one of those moments that, like, I don't know, like, if you, it's, I mean, it's also what Meryl Streep said, you know, take your broken heart and make it into art. Like, even in this situation, I'm totally brokenhearted that he won.
Yeah.
Or not won, whatever you want to say. I don't know how you can call yourself a winner with 22% of the total U.S. voting population. You can, I don't know how you can call yourself a winner with 22% of the total. Anyway, it's totally bizarre. But I think it's an opportunity to make us do something that we've never done before, and that is get outside of your comfort zone and open your mouth at, you know, and I try not, here's what I do have some parameters, though, like, about, like, you know what, like, I feel like Melania is, I mean, she's an adult woman who has consented to this, you know what I mean?
Right.
But she also strikes me as kind of someone who is like a Russian bride who's been trafficked into the situation.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? And so there's some consent on this, on her part, but also, like, you know, there, I kind of feel like she, not that she's off limit, because if something comes up that, you know, then she's not off limits. But there are some parameters. Like, there's people who didn't consent to this, like his youngest kid. So for me, it's like, what would be the point of, like, ripping into him? Like, I'm going to stay on top of Kellyanne Conway, Donald Trump, and all of his nominees to different cabinets, and speak out about everything and constantly post about it. Because, you know what? You might reach somebody who didn't know that that was the case.
Right.
So I just feel like, you know, we had it pretty easy the last 8 years. Soon as, like, Obama took office, like, the large majority of people breathed a sigh of relief and were like, okay, good. You know, even though he was blocked at in every direction to get a lot done, he did get a lot done. But,
right.
But he was blocked, and so we've had it pretty easy. So I think to myself, okay, you know what, you can never rest. You can never think that we're done, because we're not. Because it's not just this country, but, you know, people are talking about immigration as if it's something that directly affects them, and I'm sorry, it doesn't.
Right.
Like, you know, our country decimated Mexican farms with NAFTA, and their number one export was corn, and we decimated their farms. And so families are coming looking for work, and they're looking for work on this side of the border because we basically destroyed their economy.
Yep.
So you want to talk about, and then they come here and they work on farms, and basically for pennies on the dollar, and it's work that white people will never ever do, and pennies on the dollar that they only send back to Mexico to feed their families back there. It's like, and so tell me how again that immigration, the people who bitch about it, how it's affecting you. It's not. You like lettuce? Then let people come here to work, because if you don't, then you won't have lettuce anymore. I mean, basically, that's a fact.
Yeah.
Like, so people don't understand. Like, so I'm thinking, it's not just this country that we need to, like, fix and heal. It's also all of these other countries that we have directly impacted by our policies. So it's not just us that we need to look out for. It's like, I'm thinking on a much broader scope than just this country. So we're so far from done, and it's not just us that needs to be fixed. So how do I combine comedy? And it's going to be easier than ever. I mean, we thought George W. Bush was easy. This guy, I mean, he's like, it's so ridiculous how friggin' easy it's going to be to, like, make fun of and, you know, to call out and make humor out of his ridiculousness. So I think as a comic, it kind of gives you license to say whatever you want.
Sure.
But I encourage anybody to take on that ownership as well and say whatever you want and don't stop and keep pushing and call out anyone for what they're saying, whether it's locally or whether it's, you know, nationally or internationally. So I'll tell you one of the things that I feel like I'm doing, that there's an organization called Sleeping Giants that is like going to white supremacist websites like Breitbart and looking at taking snapshots of their ads and then tweeting the snapshot at the business that did the ad buy.
Yeah.
And then they're getting them to remove their ads. And so thousands and thousands of ads have been removed from,
wow,
from Breitbart Media Buy. So this is how those people make their money. They have a website, tons of people read it. They have the ads there. People click on them. They get paid for the click. If there's no ads there, then they make no money. So it's like they'll have to go get a friggin' day job. Hopefully, these kinds of things, people's creative ways of resistance and fighting back and fighting hateful messages like that are really incredible. So
amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Again, listeners, we're here with Ian Harvey, comedian, actor, writer, change agent. You got to give a shout out to what they can find over there on CISO. Tell everybody what's on there.
So I filmed this fall, I filmed my one-hour comedy special called May the Best Cock Win. And CISO is a digital network just like Netflix and just like Hulu and Amazon. And you can download the app on your Roku or you can get it through Amazon. And it's only $4 a month. And if you would like to see the special for free, all you have to do is use my last name, Harvie, and you get 2 months of CISO free. And then if you don't want it, you can cancel it after that. But if you want to keep it and watch all these other comedy specials and comedy TV shows, it's a comedy network, much like Comedy Central. However, it is a digital network, and it's through NBC, NBC's digital comedy network.
Love it. I was watching clips, laughing so hard. What is coming up for you that you are excited about?
I am going to Texas Sunday and performing at University of Texas Austin, which I'm very excited about. I'm going back in February to do a fundraiser for Planned Parenthood there because they're trying to raise money to build a big fence around the property so that people can't harass them. So I'm going to do a fundraiser so they can build a wall around the property. Isn't that great?
That's anyway, amazing.
So going back in February to do that, that will be on my schedule. And actually, any of the other things that I'm doing are all on my calendar on my website.
There it is.
Which is ianharvey.com.
There it is. Listeners, this is what we need you to do right this very second. You, of course, as he just said, you need to go to ianharvey.com. That's Harvie. And you can learn all about the incredible things that Ian's doing. Go see him live. And go on over to CISO. And you can use Ian's last name or you can buy a subscription because we like supporting comedy. That's a great thing. And you can watch May the Best Cock Win. It has been such a joy following your career, Ian. I feel like in your head, all you've been screaming for the past, you know, a couple weeks is it doesn't feel real to you until you come back on our show to reflect on the past 3 years. So I'm happy to have provided that opportunity for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much. Happy 3-year anniversary. Let's do it again in a year or in another 3 years.
I'm all for it.
Congratulations on your longevity on your show.
Well, thank you so much, Ian. You're doing incredible stuff, and please keep using your voice in the way that you're using it, because holy cow, does it make a difference. Are you entertaining us? Absolutely. But you're also drawing our attention to things that we need to be paying attention to. So please, Ian Harvey, keep doing what you're doing.
Keep doing what you're doing. Thank you very much.
Make them laugh, make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh? My dad said be an actor, my son. But be a comical one. They'll be standing in lines for those old honky-tonk monkey shines. Now you could study Shakespeare and be quite elite, and you could charm the critics and have nothing to eat. Just slip on a banana peel, the world's at your feet. Make them laugh, make them laugh, make them laugh. Make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh?
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, there are so many incredible folks out there using their voice in their own way to make a difference. And here we are bringing another one to you on this week's episode. Let me introduce him. Dr. John Higgins is a speaker, an educator, a thought leader, and so much more. With years and years of experience in education, social justice, and grassroots movements, he is focused on public speaking, researching and working with the media on issues centered on people of color, LGBTQ storytelling, and marginalized communities. In September of 2016, Dr. Higgins launched a YouTube page where he posts weekly videos about social justice issues, and he began sharing pieces of a mini documentary highlighting stories related to his life as a queer black man growing up in the inner city of San Bernardino, as well as being the first person in his family to attain a doctoral degree. We'll talk about that. John serves as the Assistant Director of Multicultural Services and Adjunct Professor at California State University, Long Branch, and he continues to lecture all over the country on intersectionality, race, gender, and sexuality. He was named to the 2015 National Black Justice Coalition's Top 100 LGBTQ People to Watch, and he has been featured in Mused Magazine and TheRoot.com. Right this second, he is here with us. John, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
We have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
Yes, yes.
All right, look, I know your field. I was a dean of students for 10 years. I know this work. I also know that no little boy out there says, you know what, I want to be the assistant director of multicultural services when I grow up. Where did it start for you?
Yeah, well, a lot of it had to do with, you know, kind of my experience in higher education. I think for me, when I first kind of set out to go to college, unbeknownst to my own, you know, kind of walk in things, I was a resident assistant, and I got really involved in college, meaning, you know, I was connecting with my residents, the people that lived in my halls, was connecting with a lot of people that I went to school with and was, you know, joining clubs and, you know, thought about joining a fraternity, but just didn't have the time to do it. And so the more I got involved, the more I started finding myself being connected to the experiences that, you know, were happening within, you know, campus life. And so as time progressed and as things kind of went on and, you know, and I went back and said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and go do a master's and just really work towards, you know, bettering myself in terms of my educational journey. It was other queer individuals reaching out to me and basically saying, hey, you know, you're setting a great example. We look up to you or we want to connect with you. We share a little bit of your story. You really want to know how we can kind of follow in your footsteps. And so when I said, let me go ahead and get into kind of this work, this work of multicultural affairs, I was actually only not really even interning. I was doing some volunteer work with the Gay Straight Alliance of Los Angeles. And it was in that moment that working with the community, working with other queer individuals and working with folks who really had shared a lot of the same experiences and stories that I shared, that I recognized that at an educational level, I needed to be the one to kind of, you know, kind of do the work. And so as time progressed and as things kind of moved on and I moved up the ranks, you know, I started my doctoral degree. I left, you know, the field. I was working in housing for a little bit. As I moved into the work that I'm doing now, I've learned that the work that what I could be doing is so much bigger than just being behind a desk. And that is the reason why I spend a lot of time, you know, or in terms of my free time or taking time off to go out and go to other institutions to speak. I find that to be a passion area of mine because, one, it not only centers my story in relation to the stories that other folks have, but it also helps other folks to get a better understanding of what it means to work with someone who is, you know, someone like me. You're working with someone who's a first-gen student. You're working with someone who's queer. You're working with someone who comes from a single-parent household. You're working with someone who was African-American. These are all of the things that, you know, make my intersectional experience what it is. And so when you're working with that individual, when you're having to deal with the issues that come up with working with that individual, how do we have these conversations? How do we have the tough conversations that are going to allow us to be able to better serve and better help students navigate their own experiences to become, again, what I like to preach, better and more thought, more intuitive, more thought-provoking, more critical of what's happening around them. How do we change the world in relation to that? So that's what got me into this work, the idea of wanting to be able to change the world by one story at a time.
I love it. Nothing makes me happier than some story that starts with, and then I became an RA. Because I honestly, I think my parents still think I am an RA, so we're there. I'm there. That's what they, when people ask my folks, what does he do? They say, I think he's still an RA. It's where it starts. It's where it starts.
That is so true.
Let's get personal for a second. What does it mean to be the first person in your family to attain a doctoral degree?
one, I'll be very honest, struggle. That word comes up a lot in a lot of the stuff that I do and a lot of the talks that I give.
Yeah.
I always say that, something that Melissa Harris Perry said in one of her presentations that I've seen was the struggle was always real. And I think as much as that may be funny to some people, it really is real for a lot of us. I mean, I'm thinking about when I first started applying to college, right? So there are all these moments in my life where I always kind of call them the light bulb moments. Of when I saw my full potential. I remember I worked full time in my senior year because I couldn't financially afford to one, be applying to all of the colleges that I was applying to, but also to, thinking about prom, thinking about grad night, all those different things. My mom was a single parent. She said, I can't afford that. So I was working and, and as I started applying to colleges, I started getting a lot of, I don't think that that's a good idea for you. I think you should go here. Or I think you should do a trade school. There were a lot of folks who didn't believe in the capacity that I could have to be successful in higher ed. And so as I started doing that, and as I started applying, as I started kind of putting in the applications, it became this idea of me having to kind of one up myself because I was also starting to believe a lot of the stuff people were saying. And when I did get accepted to the college that I got accepted to, actually I had applied for 4 institutions and got accepted to all 4 of them. That was the first moment in my life where I was like, wow, I actually am smart and I actually can go on to do what I think I can do. And so when I got to college, it was hard because my mom, my mother, she's an amazing woman and has always been an amazing person. But my mom didn't understand the difference between a 2-year versus a 4-year. Right. I went straight into a 4-year. So being in a 4-year institution and having issues with financial aid and having issues with professors and, and being in remedial courses, all these things are happening around me and I'm trying to explain them to my mom and my mother's just looking at me like, I can't help you, so I don't know what you want me to do, but I can't help you. And so I then begin to have to rely heavily on like my educational opportunity, the person that was in that role for me. I had to rely on, some of my bosses. I had to rely on people that had been in student affairs or had been working at the university for a very long time. And so as it progressed, as I moved into my master's program, the same thing. How do I have these conversations with someone who doesn't have a master's? And then even getting to my doctoral level, it became even more of a struggle to communicate my struggle in my own right because, again, I have family and friends who have never even opened a book or have never even had a conversation about what it means to be a doctoral candidate. And so I think at the end of the day, someone wants to ask me, what does it mean in your life to be the first person to do anything? I think it's this idea of constantly having to set trends in your life that have never, there's no outline, there's no outline. There's nobody who can ultimately help you and guide you through all of the things that you're going through in those moments that you're having to make those decisions.
Amazing stuff. Well, we have to call it out. Look, I know this field pretty darn well. And I think one of the arguments in doing the work that we do is all those naysayers out there who say, yes, but college campuses, those aren't real places. Those are set apart from the real world. How do we bridge that gap between the type of work that we do on college campuses and the quote unquote real world?
The real world. Well, and I think that's very interesting because, I had a student just recently say to me, this is my last semester and I don't know what my life is going to look like afterwards. And I think college for me, I was very grateful that a lot of the people that were in my life as a college student are still in my life now. They really helped set a precedent for me to say, these are decisions you need to make now and these are the decisions you can make later.
Right.
And you need to be very critical about the decisions that you're going to make now because they are going to affect you later. One thing that I preach is to never get so caught up in, building someone else's dream that you lose your own. I'm always challenging students that I work with to find their dreams and to find what drives them and what really pushes them to become what's pushing them to become the person they want to become. I had one student tell me, oh, I really want to work for, MTV and I want to do this and I want to do that. I was like, well, why aren't you pursuing it? I think that's the thing that education, I think, higher ed as a whole, whether it's a 2-year or 4-year, you have people that have been in these roles and people that have been in these experiences or have been in the places that a lot of these students are in. And they are the ones that are ultimately telling our youth or telling people, go after what matters to you. If you're passionate about an idea or if you're passionate about something, you know, to change something in this world, right, do that. And so I oftentimes share a story even in my own life, you know, how, you know, one of the things that I use, I say the hood raised me, but education saved me. And I think of it from that perspective of I grew up in one of the worst areas of California. San Bernardino, I don't know if you know the ranking, is ranked as number two, is one of the worst cities in the U.S. And so growing up in the city, there were a lot of things that I saw and a lot of things that happened to me. But one of the most pivotal pieces in that story is that I grew up going to a elementary, a middle school, and a high school that is in an area that is impoverished or that's underserved. So growing up, I never got told I was smart. I was always told that I was problematic because I was the one asking for more stuff to do in the classroom. I would get done with my work too fast and people would say, oh, he's rushing through his work. He's not, you know, he's not really paying attention and he's that. And it wasn't that I was rushing through my work. It was just I literally understood it and comprehended it. And I was like, I'm bored. I'm really, really bored. And so I say all of that to say that in my journey, not being reaffirmed as smart throughout my life really hurt me in a lot of ways, especially when I started getting into kind of my core college classes, because I was now seeing stuff that I had never seen before. And I was really, again, imposter syndrome always came up. Imposter syndrome was always there. And so long story short, I get into a class and one of the professors in the classroom, for the first time in my life, he called me one of the smartest people in the room. And he would oftentimes say that in every single class that I would be in. And so he would say, you know, Jonathan's one of the most smartest people in the room. You better work with him. Or are you working with Jonathan? He's one of the smartest people in this room. You know, I don't know why nobody wants to be his partner, because you're obviously, you're missing something. And so I was always the person that I always had to like fight off member work, because people would always like clamor to me to do the work. And when I did ask him if he was saying that just to be like funny or to be facetious, he was like, no, I truly believe that you are one of the smartest people. And so I say all of that to say that I think college is where, for some students, there are two directions that college, what college can do for someone. One, it oftentimes helps students recognize this is not for me. This is not what I want to do with my life. I'm good on this. I can go do something else. Okay, that's fine. But then there are folks who truly believe that education can really help them get somewhere. And I think that a lot of the educators and a lot of the people doing the work really affirm that. And so, again, I think at the end of the day, college definitely bridges this idea that you already know what you need to know. You just have to believe in yourself that you really do know it and utilize it and apply it.
There it is. There it is. Mm-hmm. There's that magical word that exists out there in the universe that people throw out there, and I don't think they know exactly what it means. What do we do with the magical word of intersectionality?
The magical word of intersectionality. I think it's, you know, I look at it from the perspective of we all have a story. I frame it from the perspective of we're onions, and people laugh when I use that in my analogies. When I go into my presentations, I say, we are all onions and we are all layers. And I said, and when you start to pull back the layers of an onion and you get to the core of the onion, obviously that's where the most potent, you know, the most potency of an onion lies is in the core. But I think at the end of the day, what we do with intersectionality is we understand those layers and we understand where those layers connect. And we have to understand and process it from a perspective of, I may not fully understand your struggle or I may not fully comprehend what you've been through, but I want to help you get to where you need to go, even though you've gone through it. And so I think back to even thinking about me, you know, being Black first and then being queer and being a first-gen student and then also being from a single-parent household, these are all intersectional experiences that shape the way that I see the world. But I always tell people, I don't want a handout. Don't just give me a handout because you feel bad for me, but help me understand how I can utilize what I know and what I've learned to make myself a better individual or to make this world a better place. And so I think that that's the key thing with intersectionality. I think we get caught up in looking at all of the things that make up a person, and we sometimes forget that those individuals, they have stories, they have experiences, they have things that they've gone through that make them who they are. And it's really about what can we truly learn from those experiences. You know, thinking even about, you know, someone who might be Muslim and might be queer, right? I don't have the Muslim identity, but I know that I, and maybe there's a struggle between being both Muslim and queer. So what can I learn from that? And I really think that that's what Kimberly Crenshaw was really trying to get to the bottom of, is that our intersectional experiences provide opportunities for us to learn from each other when we really take a moment to think critically about what those experiences mean for the lives that we lead.
Yeah. Again, listeners, we are here with Dr. John Higgins, speaker, educator, thought leader, so much more. Look, there's a lot going on this national political landscape right now, and I don't know that everybody who perhaps doesn't do this college-type work understands how much our students are struggling to navigate, obviously, their own studies and their own student development and their identity formation, but also how to navigate, you know, this really rocky landscape. How do you approach doing this work knowing we really don't know what's coming around the corner next from the current administration?
Yeah, I think it's just staying in a place of empathy.
Yeah.
I think if we've got to start, and I think that's the thing I've been really pushing. I just recently did a talk with a university, and that was the thing I left everyone with. I said, you know, I can come in here and I can tell you all of the things that are wrong with this world. I can tell you everything that's wrong with you. I can tell you everything that's wrong with the institution. I can tell you everything that's wrong with our political scheme, everything. I said, but none of that will matter if I don't do it in a way where I'm truly caring for the people that I'm trying to help. And I think that that's the necessary thing. I think, you know, I say this, you know, again, I try to stay away from this whole, well, whose side are you on? Because I get that question a lot. Well, did you vote for, you know, Hillary? Did you vote for Trump? What side are you on? I'm not on anybody's side. I said, I think for me it is who has continued to work for me at my and be, you know, in my corner when I needed the most. And I think that that's the idea of how we should be helping each other in this world in this moment. You know, everyone has a story. Everyone has a struggle. Everyone has been through something, whether it be, you know, disability or whether it's racial, whether it's, you know, sexuality, wherever the pieces may fall. Everyone is walking with a story, and everyone's walking with, you know, some trouble behind that story. And so if we continue to lead our lives with this idea that I come first and what I believe to be true is everything that, you know, that matters in this moment, we're not only causing ourselves great harm, but we're causing great harm to folks who are already in marginalized situations. And actually, it's so interesting because I just got out of an interview. Actually, I just did an interview for one of the local newspapers where we were just talking about the same conversation. You know, what is your thoughts on everything that's happening? And I said, I think for me, the number one thing, you know, and I'll kind of just leave it here before I get too political. The number one thing that has really rubbed me the wrong way ever since all of this had taken off was this idea that you have someone who is sitting in a privileged position that is saying, I believe X, Y, and Z to be true. And it's this idea that this person has never had to deal with being an immigrant. This person's never had to deal with being queer. This person, so there's all these elements of privilege that are there, and now they're utilizing their privilege to hurt more people. And I just think I don't know how that person sleeps at night. Like, how does a person who doesn't take the time to step back to say, what can I do to make other people's lives better? Like, how do you look at yourself in the mirror and be okay with knowing that you're making people's lives worse than what they already are? Because life is already hard, you know? And so I think that for me has been the biggest thing, is just, I am now at a place where I go, before I make a comment, before I make a statement, before I jump on somebody, or before I like tear someone down, I'm in this place of going, what has that person been through, and what can I do to make their lives better? Like, what, just even in the 5-10 minute time that we connect, my goal is to just try to make their life better in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. It's such an important shift, right? It's getting away from the whole trope of, and I need that person whose experience I don't understand to educate me to, you know what? What can I do to enhance their life? What can I do to make mm-hmm. their life better? It's such an important shift.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very much so.
So much work to do. So much work to do. Yeah. I love your comments on award season. I honestly, by the way, folks, if you are not following this guest right this very second on Twitter, I don't know what's wrong with you. It's at Dr. John Paul. I feel you enjoy the Twitter.
I do. And you know what's so interesting about Twitter? It's so interesting that how my life has changed being now that I'm verified. just the back and forth with, you know, other celebrities about things and being able to, comment, the commentary and the being able to share other people's thoughts or being able to connect with other people's thoughts. Specifically the woman who, created the hashtag #OscarSoWhite.
Yeah.
I've learned so much from April in the last maybe 2 or 3 months that I've been tweeting back and forth with her. And she's so vocal, like in the idea that she'll email me or she's very much kind of like, she's always looking for an opportunity to help me kind of one up my mind in terms of things. And so I think that's where I'm learning a lot of like, how do I navigate these conversations? I'm watching Twitter and I'm watching social media and I'm looking at the way things are kind of unfolding. And I think for me, it helps me have a more critical lens being now that I'm a figure, that I'm that I'm considered a public figure. So
much fun. Again, listeners, at Dr. John Paul. It's all going down right there on that Twitter account, I'm just saying. For our listeners who are looking to add a bit more color to their rainbow, if you had that magic wand, for everyone who's out there saying, gosh, I don't know where to start. I'm feeling incapacitated. It's also overwhelming. Where would you tell people to start these days to make a difference?
Well, I would first tell them to check out my website
at
www.drjohnpaul.com. A lot of insight there. Connects to the articles that I've written for The Root. I'm currently now a contributor to Contrast Magazine, so my first article will be coming out with them, and there are a couple of other articles that I'm going to be doing with them in the next couple of months. But also, too, I'm actually getting ready to even do a TED Talk, and so being able to just stay connected to all of the information that I'm constantly trying to update my website with, that's all there. But I think the other piece of it too is inviting us into the conversation. And I will say this, as a queer Black influencer, I've been so thankful that there are certain mediums that have said, we want to hear your voice,
yeah.
Right? So, I mean, I got into kind of a little Twitter spat with someone from the Huffington Post recently, but even then at that moment, that person said, hey, I'm going to be doing something in the next couple of months. Can I reach out to you so that way we can connect? I think for me, it's not about me coming in and yelling about this is not inclusive or this is problematic and you don't care about me. No, I'm not here to drag anyone. I think ultimately my biggest thing is allow me to come into the conversation. Allow me to be able to speak about my experience open and freely without being offended by what I'm going to say, because at the end of the day, again, my intersections affect the way that I see the life that I lead. But I also openly think too about the idea of what privilege and what access looks like. And I think that that's the bigger thing for me, is ultimately saying, if you are a person that has access to be able to yes and no certain articles, and you're making thousands and thousands of dollars, because you are, you're an executive or you're an editor and all that, give people of color, give specifically Black and queer individuals that opportunity to write and to talk and to be very vocal and honest about their experiences. That's the only way that we can learn, is if we allow people and their voices to shine. And so, on the flip for me, I've only been at this for maybe 6 or 7 months. I've done several news articles. I just did an interview today. I've done podcasts. I'm fortunate enough to know that there are so many different people out there that are opening up the space for me to chat and to talk, but I also think about other places that are not, not trying to call out anybody, but there are certain people that have said or seen an article that I've pitched and said, oh no, I'm going to go ahead and pass on that, when it was an article that directly affected LGBTQ people of color. So if you are a person that, regardless of if you think it's a good article or not, work with that person to figure out how we can make these things better so that way we can get the information out there. Again, I think it really has to do with the idea of, think about Willy Wonka, right? Like, we go back to the chocolate factory. Willy Wonka had the opportunity to let people come into his chocolate factory. And he did. He gave out tickets and he allowed people to. And even though there were rotten people that had came in, the idea was, in that entire analogy, was that he was giving someone access to something that they would have not been able to in any other way. So are we going to be the Willy Wonkas? Are we going to allow the people to come in and share the joy and learn and be able to fully, talk openly about their experiences? Or are we going to continue to keep shutting doors? I think that's kind of where I'm at with that.
And where's the reboot where some people of color actually get into the chocolate factory?
Right. That too, right?
There's also that.
Inclusiveness. Yeah, there's also that.
Listeners, this is what we need you to do straight away. Stroll on over to Dr. John Paul. That's Dr. JohnPaul.com. You can learn all about the incredible work that is happening there. You can learn all about how existence is resistance and watch some videos and check out things that he has written. And there's so much more coming down the pike. And of course, as I said, you need to follow him on Twitter. You, sir, are using your voice in such an important way. Yes, this is my field, so I love it when I see other people from higher education out there using their voice to make a difference, and you just have such an engaging energy that really makes people stop and listening. It's a beauty to behold.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination.
Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation.
What we'll see will defy explanation.
If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we do have some time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. The big news this week was a lack of news. There was a lot of chattering at the start of the week that the Trump administration was going to do something. They were going to do something anti-gay. Apparently, there's a Twitter account for some rogue staffers there in the White House, and they said there's something anti-LGBT that's coming down the pike. There's all these different executive orders, and there's something coming down the pike. But what we found out is that that didn't really come to pass. Donald Trump will not be scrapping protections for LGBT workers put in place by President Obama, despite claims during his presidency bid that he would repeal a lot of the previous administration's actions. The White House confirmed a commitment to, quote, protect the community from violence and oppression. In 2014, President Obama signed an executive order banning LGBT workplace discrimination by federal contractors and the federal government. The bill applied to roughly 24,000 companies and 28 million employees, a fifth of America's overall workforce. However, there had been fears that that order would be axed after Trump assumed office. And in fact, Press Secretary Sean Spicer fueled unease after he responded, quote, "I just don't know," when he was asked about the bill's fate. But then the White House released a statement saying this, quote, "President Trump continues to be respectful and supportive of the LGBTQ rights, just as he was throughout the election. The president is proud to have been the first ever GOP nominee to mention LGBTQ community in his nomination acceptance speech, pledging then to protect the community from violence and oppression." So there you go. It's kind of a lack of news. But if you are out there in any conceivable way celebrating that the President of the United States did not take action against us, you, my friends, you're kind of a moron. I refuse to celebrate. I know I never do name calling, and I don't really mean that. I love you guys, and I love that you listen, and I love your support, and all that's great. But you should not be celebrating that someone isn't attacking us. Yay, they're not attacking us is not a rallying cry. And by the way, I mean, look, we've been talking about intersectionality all episode long. We have to be engaged in intersectionality. This is not the only executive order that's out there right now, right? This ban on Muslims affects all of us. And so we cannot just stand up when we think the issue affects LGBTQ people. We have to raise our voices, because only by showing up for other communities do we actually create unity, where perhaps in the future, which it's totally going to happen, if something comes up that is anti-LGBTQ, as is coming down the pike without question, with some sort of freedom of religion, Religious Freedom Protection Act, saying, yes, you can discriminate against the LGBTQ population if you have a, quote, sincerely held religious belief. That is coming, right? If we've not shown up for other communities as we should be doing, because that's what we should be doing, then we can't stand up and say, where is everyone when we need them? So you have to be raising your voice this week. If your airport is doing something, there's a protest there, head your way over there. We have to show up for everyone else. On the flip side, a lot of news stories out there saying that some far-right religious groups are very much not happy with Trump. And for me, that's important to recognize, because there are people who want LGBTQ protections rolled back. Again, it's not even about, right, like I can almost understand, and I've said this so many times over the past 8 years on the show, I can almost understand if there's a right that is up for a vote, and we're deciding, well, should we give it to the gay community, should we not give it to the gay community? And you have all these people fighting and saying we should not give this to the gay community. But that people donate their time and energy and tons of money to say we need to roll back protections, that's just a horrible spiritual thing to put out there into the world. We're going to take away something that's already given. You can't feel good about that karma, folks. So that is not the only Trump-related LGBTQ news. Donald Trump has chosen the famously anti-LGBT fundamentalist Jerry Falwell Jr. to head a federal task force on Department of Education policy. Falwell, who is the president of Liberty University, sees his appointment as, quote, a response to what he called overreaching regulation and micromanagement by the department. And this, my friends, as much as we're all paying attention to Betsy DeVos and what happens there, we should be paying attention to what's going to happen in higher education, because apparently Jerry Falwell Jr. is going to be the one heading that task force. And this is a guy who's president of a university who, in their code of conduct, it states, quote, sexual relations outside of a biblically ordained marriage between a natural-born man and a natural-born woman are not permissible. The university has hosted several anti-LGBT events, including some that endorse conversion therapy. Among other far-right positions, the school supports creationism and total climate change denial. And this is a guy who is now heading the task force on higher education. Now we're in my world, folks. This is what I do for a living. I know you're thinking, oh, well, Ken, he just does his radio show full time. Wow, you're wrong. No, that's not what I do. I'm a college professor. And he very much, Jerry Falwell Jr., far-right, anti-LGBT Jerry Falwell Jr., is very much in a position to roll back protections on college campuses. So that is cause for great, great concern. I will definitely be talking about that in class this week. More news. Indiana, this is how they're spending their time, at least some folks here. Indiana is set to appeal a ruling from 2016 which led to same-sex parents being listed on the birth certificates of their children. A federal judge ruled last year that Indiana must list the names of both mothers on the birth certificates of their children. U.S. District Judge Tanya Walton Pratt issued the judgment in favor of 8 lesbian couples, saying it was intended to end the discriminatory practice of previously only naming the birth mother on the certificates. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill, however, did not agree with the ruling, saying the state would appeal, and now, indeed, they are going to spend your taxpayer money there in the state of Indiana appealing that decision. What an absolute waste. Absolute waste of time and money And there you go. In South Dakota, an anti-LGBT bathroom bill has been withdrawn in South Dakota at its first stage of the legislative process. Legislators in the state had been considering the bill, which was introduced last week. It would mean public school students would have to use locker, shower rooms, and changing facilities corresponding to the sex assigned at birth. A similar bill was vetoed by Governor Dennis DeGarde last year, but this latest bill was withdrawn at the committee stage. Senate Education Committee Chairman Jim Boland said this week. Sponsor Senator Lance Russell did not comment on his reasons for withdrawing the bill. The governor said that if he vetoed the bill, if it looks the same as last year, he's going to veto it again. So what are you wasting money on? And again, he pointed to North Carolina's example. And we should all be pointing to North Carolina's example because we need to learn something from the state of North Carolina, where they have lost hundreds of millions of dollars due to their bathroom bill. So if you are in any way associated with anything related to business there in the state of South Dakota, you need to raise up your voice and say, hey, this is not going to be good for us here, because indeed, it's not going to be good for you there. Unbelievable that we persist. This is what we spend our energy on, and again, taxpayer money. Happy news, the happiest news of the week, the Boy Scouts of America. They have announced that they are changing their policy to allow trans boys to enroll in their programs. This week, the Boy Scouts of America announced that they had made the decision to change their policy to mean that the gender listed on an application to become a scout is the base for their enrollment process. Previously, and famously, the Boy Scouts of America had checked the birth certificate of each applicant. The organization said the decision was based on various states and communities changing the way legal gender is defined. The decision came after, as we talked about a few weeks ago, an 8-year-old boy and his family announced that they were suing the New Jersey Boy Scouts Council after the boy was kicked out of the troop for his gender identity. Joe Maldonado and his mother, Kirsty, are claiming that the council violated state law against discrimination. The young boy, who has identified as a boy since 2 years old, was accepted into the Scouts in October, but kicked out the following month after parents allegedly complained about his trans status. And the big update to that story is he has been asked to rejoin. So that is very exciting. Effie DeLaMarcos, a spokeswoman for the Boy Scouts of America, said that Joe, that boy, was kicked out because he did not meet eligibility requirements. The Boy Scouts of America grants youth membership to Cub Scouts to boys in the first through fifth grades or 7 to 10 years of age. If needed, we defer to the information provided for an individual's birth certificate and their biological sex. That was previously the policy, and now they have changed that. That is very exciting. And if you're thinking, what does progress look like? This, without question, is what progress looks like. This is it. I love it. I love it. Some coming out news, very exciting stuff. The mayor of a small town in North Texas just came out as transgender. Jess Herbst, who is the mayor of New Hope, wrote an open letter to residents of the town saying that she is trans. Herbst also urged constituents to ask questions if they are unsure about anything to do with her transition. She says she will continue to serve as the mayor of New Hope, and in her letter she said this, quote, "As the new mayor of New Hope, I would like to tell you all what a privilege it is to serve you. Since 2003, I've had the privilege of being an alderman and a road commissioner. In May of 2016, I became your mayor. My wife has lived in New Hope since she was 2 years old. Along with our two daughters, we have lived here since 1999. On the same farm my wife was raised. I was born and raised in Greenville, Texas. As your mayor, I must tell you about something that has been with me since my earliest memories. I am transgender. 2 years ago, with the support of my wife, daughters, and son-in-law, I began hormone replacement therapy. At the time, I did not imagine I would hold the mayor's position, but here I am." And she goes on to explain more about her life. This is how the world changes, my friends. This is how the world changes. When they are in a position, and to do it safely, to come out and be their authentic selves. So huge congratulations to Mayor Herbst there in New Hope and to the entire town of New Hope, because you have an even more authentic mayor right now. Our huge thanks to Ian Harvey. We love that Ian Harvey. He is just hilarious. And of course, to Dr. John Higgins, doing incredible work with his voice. If you have not yet signed up, I encourage you. We're getting closer and closer to my book launch, and it's getting more and more exciting. So go on that interweb, go to kenschneck.com/seriously, kenschneck.com/seriously, and you can sign up for more information about my book. Very exciting stuff. And thank you guys, as always, for listening. Get out there. Go use your voice to make a difference, to lift up the voices of your fellow LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of those allies out there. Make a difference. Use your voice. And while you're out there, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?